You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 37 of Atheistically Speaking. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. Thanks for listening. So, last week was great. We had Massimo Piliucci, and I really enjoyed that. This week, we're changing pace a little bit with a debate with Blake Genta, who was on Dogma Debate recently. It's very, very interesting. Looking forward to that. And my Patreons will know, the premium content subscribers, that I wrote a bit about that and why I thought that debate wasn't exactly fruitful. But we'll get to that later. In the meantime, let's have some Tomentary. So we've been talking a lot about scientism lately. On one hand, we've had Neil deGrasse Tyson openly disparaging philosophy, calling it dead and a waste of time and such. And then, of course, I had Massimo Piliucci last week to talk about the other side of the argument, how important philosophy still is and what it has contributed to the world. As an aside, I so far haven't gotten any comments on what I thought was a pretty decent observation about Piliucci's analysis of the moral landscape. I feel pretty strongly that he's misrepresenting Harris's views on a few things. I just want to check in with you guys and see if, did anyone find my points compelling, or did you did and you didn't say anything, or you didn't and you felt you didn't want to comment? I don't know. I'm just wondering. Curiously, I didn't get a single comment regarding what I thought. I think that Piliucci just didn't look deeply enough, and or he had his sort of made up his mind already, maybe for justified reasons, about Harris. And I think he ignored a little bit of nuance about the things I pointed out last week, basically. So let me know. I don't know. Let me know what you thought about that. Who knows? Maybe no one made it that far into Thursday's episode. Maybe no one's, everyone turned it off after Piliucci left. Anyway, beyond the Harris thing, I think I made it pretty clear that I'm a fan of philosophy. I really enjoy it. I always like doing it. The classes I've taken, I've really enjoyed. Though I do think that science is more important to our everyday lives, personally. No one has changed my mind on that either. But I was listening to Philosophy Bites, which there you go, another indication that that I'm a fan of philosophy. A lot of my best friends are philosophers. No. Well, I was listening to Philosophy Bites, which is a podcast I highly recommend, and I heard something that sort of pointed out some of the ways that I think philosophy can be kind of irrelevant in some ways, or maybe elitist, almost, in my view. The episode featured Simon Blackburn, who was talking about narcissism and vanity and what the differences are. In Blackburn's words, it is the eternal problem of the self, and he went on, like, what's the right balance of all these qualities, or the Aristotelian mean? And while I found this somewhat interesting, I couldn't help, as I was listening, I couldn't help but think these issues are far better explored in the field of psychology. The problem to me is that he's sort of discussing narcissism in this utopian sort of way where everyone can be in a position to have time for lots of self-reflection, and then this reflection, you know, will yield the correct answers, and then in turn these correct answers can in fact change who they are and how they act in the world and stuff like that. In reality, it seems like it's rarely the case. So much of this, I believe, is based on self-esteem, which studies have shown is incredibly difficult to change when you're raised in an environment that yields low self-esteem. You're sort of stuck with it in a lot of ways. I can definitely say that's true for me. I have really bad self-esteem, which I think manifests itself in very negative ways in my life. And no amount of philosophizing on the Aristotelian mean of vanity is going to change it. I work really hard to sort of change my thinking, but it's very programmed into me from my upbringing, I think. So furthermore, even if some people are capable of changing their personalities by thinking about the issues, which I don't think I can, I think I've made minuscule changes. and with a lot of work, it can be quite a select group of people who are, you know, the people who would be able to do this would have to be well off, properly educated so as to be exposed to this philosophy, and properly intelligent so as to be able to understand it. So to my mind, there's kind of a lot of privilege inherent in this kind of thinking. How meaningless is this philosophy to people who are struggling to even make ends meet? They don't have time for it. A counter to my argument might be that while there are parts we can't control, maybe there are things that we can change about ourselves by applying philosophical thought to them. To this, I would say that may be true, but it seems like it's a minority of people who would even be capable of this. And it's a minority of elements about ourselves that I think reflection can really change. The evidence that I've seen seems to bear this out. I've looked up a few studies. So I would be far more interested in what psychology tells us here. What are the numbers? Can people's self-esteem actually change? That's an empirical question. If so, how? If not, what are the best ways of raising children in the first place to produce a healthy amount of the qualities that we're looking for? All these seem to be scientific questions. And Dennett has said that philosophy is what you're doing when you haven't found the right questions to ask yet. If this is the case, then maybe what I was just doing was a minute ago was philosophy, but I'd be fine with that. Organizing the thoughts and data in the right way to ask the right questions is undeniably useful. But now that these questions are posed, I'd be much happier with psychology taking the reins from here than I would with a philosopher telling me what the right amount of pride is. All right, with me today is Blake, and I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce your last name.
It is Junta.
Junta. Okay. Blake Junta. Had I not known that, that would have sounded like some sort of like slur to me. It sounds like a curse word or something. I don't know. I would have been a little nervous to say Junta. If you say it angrily enough, it doesn't sound too pleasant.
Right.
So I heard you on Dogma Debate, and I wanted to get in contact with you. I posted on my Patreon page about it because I just was I don't know. I was a little turned off by how they sort of treated you there. Not to try to trash talk them or anything, but it seemed just not very fruitful to me on that particular event.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And in their defense, I know David didn't expect that. It was kind of experimental. He didn't, you know, Aaron coming in was something that was as a result of him apparently bringing in some extra listeners or donations or something. And so he kind of won his spot. And so now they had an extra person. And like you say, he doesn't normally let Aaron in for those types of situations. And I love Aaron. He's great. But it was just, like you said at the end, there were just too many people on mic. So it was unfortunate.
Yeah, too many people and none of them with any patience for philosophy. It just seemed like if that was going to be how you were going to do it, I mean, then they needed to frame the debate differently. They needed to frame the debate as, you know, can philosophy provide evidence for something, or, you know, start somewhere like that rather than, you know, prove that God exists and then, well, we reject every single way that you even reason about it. You know, it just didn't, I don't know. That didn't work for me.
Yeah, it was difficult. And again, David said he shouldn't have said, I hate, he said a couple of times, oh, I hate philosophy. But in the next show, he tried to clarify, he doesn't hate philosophy.
He hates philosophers. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. He's just wary. I mean, so a lot of I'm introducing terms like possibility and necessity, and this is stuff that, you know, if you don't study philosophy, it can sound foreign to you, it can sound slippery. And so, I mean, I can kind of understand his hesitance to go along with what I'm saying. And kind of like Rachel said at the beginning, it feels like he's being set up for a trap. But I don't know if that was necessarily any fault of his. It was just it was the circumstances.
So. Yeah, I understand. I'm not trying to trash talk. It's just that was what sort of brought, you know, made me want to bring you on, because I'm not a philosopher, but I like philosophy, and I'm happy to have anyone who, basically my thing on this show is that I'm happy to have anyone on who's willing to defend their beliefs. My show's not really I don't know if you familiarized yourself at all, but it's not really the same kind of show. I'm not trying to debate a whole lot, but it's something that I wanted to do as an experience. My show's designed to be more like meta-atheism kind of. But because I sort of think that debating is such a key part, it's such, something so many atheists and some religious people want to do, I just thought it would be really cool. And I also wanted to do it in a way that would be more more patient, more long form, not trying to score style points and stuff like that. I just kind of want to, so I thought it would be perfect. You'd be a perfect fit. You know, we could discuss these arguments more at length and without people yelling at you in the middle of the, in the middle of them and cursing philosophy and that kind of thing. So
yeah, just kind of have fun truth seeking together, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. If you wouldn't mind, can you give a little bit of background, maybe just because there are so many different kinds of faiths and everything, maybe a little outline of what your beliefs are, just so we know kind of, you know, whether we're dealing with a young earth creationist or a, you know, that kind of thing, just so if you don't mind.
So, I mean, I'm an evangelical Christian. I'm not a young earth creationist. If anything, I would be probably leaning towards old earth creationism. And if it depends on how you define that. So I'm sympathetic to common descent. I'm not entirely sold on it, but I think the evidence for common descent is pretty good. I'm not as sold on the idea that Darwinistic processes brought about the common descent. So that's my view on creation. I think the universe is 13.7 billion years old. I think the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. So I accept the traditional datings. I've just very recently, just in the past couple months, launched a website called treesearch.org. And what I've wanted to do for a long time is make an apologetics website that is a little more academically oriented. So I'm very interested in making sure I have these proper citations from these academic sources, which is not the way that apologetics is done a lot of the time. And moreover, what I wanted to do is map the debate over questions like God's existence and Jesus's resurrection. And so what I've done is put together a website that has on the left what's called a tree view menu. And you can explore this kind of like a debate. God exists. You open that up. You see the reasons for God's existing. If you open up any one of those reasons, then you see the objections. If you open one of those objections up, then you see the objections to the objections. And it's got a lot of growing to do. But the idea is I want to map the debate so that people can, with unprecedented efficiency, start learning the back and forth.
Exactly how they're wrong about God not existing. Yeah. Yeah, that's great stuff. I disagree with some of the stuff on it, but I think the site's great. I encourage you to definitely keep working on that and keep, there's a lot of places where you're still, you know, stuff's forthcoming, which is, of course is going to be true with a monumental task like this. I really think it's cool. I found it fascinating to go through it. I would think as an atheist or believer, you know, check it out. It's a really cool site, cool concept, and good job on the design. I just wanted to say that. It's good. It's good
stuff. Thank you. In terms of theology, I'm kind of torn between what's called Molinism and Calvinism. So I'm not quite sure. I'm working out my thoughts there. I can defend both of them.
I can't even define either of them. So that's
yeah. It's just they're just different positions on how God relates to free will. You know, if God's omniscient, do we have free will, and how does all that work out? So there's some interesting questions there.
Right. Yeah. That's stuff I've definitely thought about. I just probably don't have the background that you have to be able to put all the names to everything. So that would be kind of where I'm coming from. I love thinking about these problems. I love philosophy and just thinking philosophically, but I'm probably not as studied and won't be able to, you know, pin exactly what the name of the argument or that sort of thing. So
yeah, that's fine. Okay. Hey, as long as you get an idea of the concepts, you enjoy learning, then, you know, we all got to start somewhere.
So the one thing that I would say, the only stipulation I'll make, I really don't even like making any stipulations, but just because this is the second debate. The first one was very exclusively on Kalam. If we can try to avoid that just for sake of repetition, if not, I'm still willing to do it, but it's just, if it can be avoided without causing you, any inconvenience to how you particularly would like to debate.
That is quite all right.
Yeah, okay. So, let me just start, let me just ask, I'm an atheist. I don't I don't accept these beliefs. Where would you kind of start? Not Kalam. without right. Kalam, where might you want to start trying to convince me?
So on dogma debate, where I tried to start is on the question of what our foundational beliefs should be, because I've found that sometimes when I speak with non-believers or atheists in particular, they might want to say something along the lines of, well, we should treat God kind of like we treat the invisible unicorn. And I don't want to include pink in there because invisible and pink are a contradiction. And let's not get into that just yet. But at least an invisible unicorn. And if someone's going to believe in an invisible unicorn, they should have evidence for it, right? That's not the type of thing that you should be agnostic about starting out. That's the type of thing you should disbelieve until you're given reason to believe it. Would you agree?
Sure. So you're going to try to carve out a different sort of set of circumstances as regards belief in God?
Yeah. So what I want to say is that there are other existence claims that are treated differently. So consider this, this existence claim. There exists a particle that is smaller than the smallest known particle, which is a quark right now. Okay. We don't have any evidence for or against this, that there's a smaller particle, at least to my awareness. And so in the absence of this type of evidence, I would say we should be agnostic about whether there's a smaller particle. But once again, we have an existence claim. It's just treated differently. Would you agree that we should be agnostic about the existence of a smaller particle?
Sure. Yeah, I can accept that.
Okay, good. And then you have a third category.
So is God an even smaller particle than that particle? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, actually, that's interesting. That's an interesting question. what would be the epistemic probability for that? But no, so then the third one, and this is what we, Aaron just went bananas over, is...
he is does that.
Yeah. Yes, he does. So the third type of existence claim that I wanted to focus on, or at least that I started to mention on the show, and then we ended up talking about it for a really long time.
Yeah, it really got sort of went off the rails, and it wasn't. I don't actually remember you even talking about this because I was so distracted by all the different places that everyone wanted to go. So this is good. I'm hearing this for the first time, even though apparently I already heard it.
Right. Yeah, so it was supposed to just be something that took, 30 seconds to a minute. Right. But
that was what frustrated me. Okay. Sorry to, now I'm going to do the very thing that I'm saying they did, but no. That was what was so frustrating with one or two of them. Now it's been, gosh, has it been a month already or like 3 weeks? It's been a little while. 2 weeks? Yeah. I don't know. But anyway, I've been so, I make so many podcasts and stuff. It's sort of the specifics of that show that I listened to have left my mind a little bit. But I do remember there was one time where I was like, oh, just let him spit out the last sentence he's trying to. If he says this one sentence, you could just grant it and then try to argue from there, just anything but what's happening now. Anyway, okay, so I won't do that. Go ahead.
I mean, that's right. And honestly, like a lot of the non-believing listeners felt the same way. So, I mean, you're not alone in right. that regard. And David at the end
said
the same thing. But anyway, this third category, I want to say our existence claims that it's not only that we shouldn't disbelieve in them, starting out. And it's not only that we shouldn't be agnostic for this third category of existence claims. They seem to be things that we ought to give benefit of the doubt. In other words, that it's rational to assume that they exist in the absence of what are called in philosophy defeaters. Okay, so what's a defeater? A defeater is a belief that either undermines or rebuts another belief. So
I'm very curious to hear how God fits in this third category.
Yeah. Well, I'm not even going to argue at this moment that God fits in the third category. I'll say, look, let's just put him in the agnostic section. That's where I'll get to. But let me flesh this out a bit.
Sure.
So the idea is here's an example of one of these existence claims. The external world exists. And this is what we spent a long time on. So solipsism is the view that other minds do not exist. So one way to articulate this is to talk about this thought that we've all had before. How do we know that we're not just in our own dream world and there is nothing to wake up to? Okay. We are all that exists, you know, and by we, I mean the thinking you, the ego.
Sure.
Okay. And it's impossible to empirically refute solipsism, because any type of, you know, experience that you could have gets subsumed into the solipsistic hypothesis itself. Right. Yes. So if you're watching some video or something, that's not evidence that, you know, you're not in, that there's an external world. That's just part of the solipsism. So you can't empirically confirm or disconfirm solipsism. Nevertheless, it is rational, I want to say, to believe that solipsism is false. And similarly, it's rational to believe that an external world exists. That's an existence claim in the absence of a defeater.
Okay.
So that's one question to start out with is, would you agree that we should probably give benefit of the doubt to the existence of an external world unless we have reason to think that there is no external world?
I don't know how we could possibly have a reason to think there's no external world, because that, like you said, that could just easily be subsumed
it wouldn't be empirical evidence. What someone would have to do is make a philosophical argument for it. So you might try to argue for it on grounds of simplicity. Maybe someone might try to say, oh, solipsism is a more simple hypothesis. And other people will come back and say, no, it's actually not more simple for these other reasons. But that's a debate among philosophers.
But
the idea is, assuming you don't have any of these convincing arguments, wouldn't you say that it's more rational to go ahead and give benefit of the doubt to the hypothesis that there really is an external world and that other people / minds really do exist?
Sure. I might need to put a finer point on that, but I'm going to let it go for now and say, sure.
Good. So what I've tried to illustrate through this is we have three separate existence claims, but they're all treated very differently. Of course, we just established one gets benefit of the doubt. The other we're agnostic about, and the other, the unicorn one, is one that we should start out assuming is false.
Okay.
And typically, the way you determine how you treat an existence claim is going to depend on what philosophers call its level of intuitiveness. And this is a technical term in philosophy. We assign what's called a prior probability to each of these existence claims. And we just find ourselves with this. It's not like we came to believe it on the basis of any particular evidence. We just instinctively assign a high prior probability to the existence of an external world. Other examples are, you know, that the laws of physics will hold tomorrow. We talked about that one on the show.
Right.
Whereas we instinctively assign a low prior probability to some other propositions.
I don't know that I would agree with that way of phrasing it. I think that the problem with assigning it as an intuitive thing is that our intuitions can be wrong about all kinds of things. So I would say that the reason it's dividing those three existence claims works is because they're very different kinds of things, and you can sort of reason about them. And I mean, if you wanted to say that intuitively, when you hear it within 3 seconds, you just spit out an answer, that might be one thing. But if you really want to look at them, I would think what would determine the benefit of the doubt would not just be a feeling or an intuition. It would be something you can reason about.
Yeah. So, I mean, you said intuitions can be wrong, and I agree with you. They can be wrong. That just is to say that they are defeasible. So if you start out with this intuitive seeming that you have that an external world exists, yes, intuitions can be wrong, but that doesn't mean you're irrational for giving your intuition benefit of the doubt here.
Well, I'll be honest with you. Okay, so maybe I do need to put the finer point on that I was saying. I don't think I can even have an intuition about an external world existing, because, I mean, that's sort of part of the solipsism. I mean, I just think of it in terms of that problem. For me, it's just there's no possible way I can determine that, like you said, that won't be subsumed within the solipsism. So for me, it's like, well, what can I do? It's just a practicality thing. I can't, there's no way, nothing will be any different if I changed my belief in that. Or rather, there's no way I can change my belief that will make any difference to me, because it's the evidence is exactly the same either way.
Yeah,
so
right.
I wouldn't say that it's like, ooh, I intuitively feel that the external world exists. I just, what I intuitively feel could be called the external world, or it could be called the, what, you know, the simulation, or whatever you're saying the version of solipsism is, the dream.
Well, so what you're picking up on is right, that the evidence for both hypotheses is identical.
Right.
You know, you have no new data coming in through your experience that allows you to differentiate between one and the other. But that's different than talking about their level of intuitiveness. So look, just to confirm, right now, you don't just believe it's practical to believe that an external world exists and that I exist and that other minds exist. What you, but you actually believe that I do really exist. Like, you're actually convinced that I exist, and you're actually convinced that your mother exists and that other people exist, right? I mean, it's not just something that you're believing for the sake of argument or just because you think it's practical. You really believe it.
I mean, I'm not trying to be fickle, but I guess I just wouldn't even think of it in those terms, because there's nothing, since the evidence is all identical, there's nothing, there's no question of, do you believe this, that's ever going to matter, because the evidence is all identical. If there was a question where my answer would actually matter, then that would change. Couldn't that point to either solipsism being correct or incorrect? I mean, there's no way it could ever matter, because all the evidence is identical. So I don't really think of it as in terms of believing. I mean, to me, it's just not even an answerable thing.
So it sounds to me like you want to take up this epistemology called evidentialism, and you want to say that unless you have, you know, this convincing or this sufficiently large degree of evidence for a proposition, you should not believe it.
But I wouldn't say I don't believe it. I would say I can't answer it. I can't answer the question. I mean, if you want to go on, I can say, for the sake of argument, sure. I mean, I guess if someone said, if someone just asked me on the street, do you believe the external world exists? I'd say, I don't think that was what I meant to pick a fight with so much as I don't think I'm using intuition, because intuition is part of either the simulation or the, you know, whatever you want to say, the dream or whatever. So I don't, that's not why I would say I believe it, but I don't know. I'd say I believe because there's no other choice, I guess. How about this? There's an infinite number of ways. Maybe you can categorize this into whatever philosophical view I'm butchering, but there's an infinite number of ways that something could be a simulation, or could be the dream, or could be, you know, there's an infinite number of different ways that that could happen. And so I have no reason to believe any one of those ways. So by default, I just guess I have to accept that none of them are true.
Yeah, so here's
for the sake of living, going on with my life.
What I'm picking up on, when you say you have no reason to believe, that is grounded in your belief that only evidence counts, and you don't want to see, you seem not to want to pay any heed to your pre-theoretical intuitions. Is that right?
Maybe, yeah. I don't think I've thought about it in those terms, but sure, I'll go along with you for now until you somehow prove that means I'm a total dick and everyone hates me because of that. No, I'm just kidding. Somehow so you prove that my personality is flawed because of that. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. No. So you're not alone. This is like a very common thing for like students coming into philosophy to naturally assume. They want to say, look, if you don't have evidence for something, you shouldn't believe it. It sounds so. So, you know, it sounds so right. And they call this evidentialism. And so, you know, if you're going to want to believe something, you're going to need to have evidence for it. But here's a challenge. There are a number of challenges, but here's one. So evidentialism is a claim about what it's rational to do and what one ought to do. But evidentialism itself can't be substantiated by evidence. So it's self-stultifying.
Doesn't it seem like everything's that way, though? Is there anything that somehow supports itself? I mean, in terms of philosophy, I don't know how that would ever work. It seems like there's some way that everything ultimately can be self-defeating, right?
I don't think so. I mean, so I'm not a classical foundationalist, but I'm a kind of foundationalist with respect to my basic beliefs, and there's no self-defeatingness there. You've got coherentists who want to say, look, if you can have beliefs justifying beliefs which justify the original belief. And if your circle is big enough, then, you know, then you're rational. But we don't want to, I don't think we want to, those guys are pretty rare.
Well, I don't think this is something I have a prepared answer for, but I can take a stab at it, I guess. In terms of evidentialism, you know, justifying itself or not. I mean,
well, it's not that it's that it defeats itself, I think.
Defeats itself.
Yeah.
Well, can your evidence for it be the fact that, that it works in life? I mean, so it's ultimately, doesn't it defeat everything if you can't believe that, you know, if you have no basis for evidentialism, doesn't that defeat everything else or no?
You mean if I don't hold to evidentialism, then any other epistemological view falls short as well because you're not.
Well, you have evidence. To hold to it somewhat, right?
Oh yeah, I agree. Yes, evidence is very important. I just want to say that there are a number of beliefs that you have, and these aren't just things that you believe for practical reasons. These are things you actually believe, and that I want to say you're actually rational for believing, but that don't have evidence for them that differentiates them from skeptical hypotheses. The other one we talked about on the show was our trust in induction. So I think that just because something has always behaved in a particular way in the past, that it will behave that way in the future. And we just have a natural intuition that in the absence of defeater, we're rational for holding on to, that the universe will behave the same with respect to law-governed action. And we're rational for doing that.
Okay, yeah, sure, until we observe something else, I guess.
Okay, so
there have been plenty of times in history where we thought something was going to be a certain way and it wasn't because of evidence, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, so you definitely want to leave yourself open to defeaters. And
okay, so that's where the defeaters come in. Okay, I think I'm on the same page with you.
Here's what I ultimately want to go to is I want to say God belief, theism, is not like believing in the invisible unicorn. Either it is more like believing in an external world, or it's more like the smaller particle. Is there the particle that's smaller than a quark? It's somewhere in between there, because theism is a very natural belief, a very intuitive belief, studies show, just like these other things are intuitive beliefs, not as strong, not nearly as strong for the ones that I've been bringing up for illustrations, but strong enough to be plausible starting out. So that's
okay.
That's where I'd like to start, just to say, oh, it's not like a unicorn. This is like a serious question.
Okay, well, that's something we can certainly talk about because I do see it as the unicorn because it's the unicorn in the room around here. No, it's because I don't. That's why I said earlier I reject the idea that it's because of the level of intuitiveness. I mean, like I said, there are plenty of things that kids believe that are turn out to be stupid. I don't think that's the reason it's rational. I think the reason that it's irrational to be agnostic in terms of a invisible unicorn or a pink unicorn, or whatever it is based on evidence about the world. I mean, that would change, of course, if you had any evidence about a unicorn of any kind. I mean, that would at least improve the odds that there could, or if you had an evidence of things that existed invisibly, but were, you know, like things could change that assumption.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So here's my question to you. Why think that God is like the unicorn rather than like the smaller particle?
That sounds so zen.
I know, right?
well, okay, the smaller particle, I'll take a stab at it. I mean, I'll just answer honestly. That's what I try to do here because this is an argument I've never even heard of. So that's how ill-informed I am. But I'll try to take an honest stab at it as someone who would have to confront this information when given it. The smaller particle seems very, very easy to be agnostic about because, or at least to maybe even assume, you know, it's likely there's a smaller particle just because of the trend of discovering smaller and smaller particles.
Yeah. So you're employing inductive reasoning.
Well, but I'm not reasoning 100% though. I'm talking about why it's more justified if someone, I'm not using inductive reasoning to say 100% there's a smaller particle. I'm saying, oh, that's an interesting question. I would, I would feel like there's likely a smaller particle. I don't know. I mean, I would not be surprised if there weren't, I suppose. That's the kind of feeling I'm talking about. And that's, I suppose, yes, I'm using induction to get there.
Yeah. So yeah, it's an extrapolative inference. So the idea is, look, in the past, we've thought that we had the smallest particle, and then we've come to discover that there was a smaller particle, and then there was one after that that was smaller.
Sure.
And so
yeah,
we shouldn't be surprised if the next one, if this happens again.
Yeah.
So this is inductive reasoning, and my response to you is that inductive reasoning works in some situations and not in others. So imagine someone trying to inductively reason that every time they've come across a contradiction in the Bible, they've found a resolution to it. And imagine that this has happened, you know, 10, 20 times for them. And they really did find, answers to these particular contradictions. That shouldn't be a statement on the next contradiction that they come across. That shouldn't imply that, oh, we should expect that this next one will have an answer. It's when we use induction, what we're ultimately grounding the belief in is it's what's called a gnomic regularity. It's a regularity of the natural laws. So the reason that I can expect that the sun will rise tomorrow in virtue of its always rising in the past is because its rising in the past has told me something about how the universe operates, how the laws are. And so I'm learning about the nature of the universe. And on the basis of learning about the nature of the universe, I can start making predictions. And this is where inductive reasoning works. Inductive reasoning does not work when you're talking about something really contingent, like someone learning about, Bible contradictions, or someone about, oh, there's been a particle, now there's another particle. Because if you start
first off, I'll let you finish that. So I have several answers. First off, if we were talking to being analogous, the analogous claim would be the person reading the Bible saying, I think I might be able to answer the next contradiction. Not, oh, I 100% know I can. I was just saying, in order to have the attitude of agnosticism, excuse me. But secondly, it sounds like, to my amateur brain, it sounds like sort of different kinds of induction being done. Because like you said, I mean, that kind of an induction is not the class of things that's happening very wildly. I mean, we have no idea the nature of these contradictions. We have no idea, what was involved, like what the range of differences can be in these. I mean, they could easily just... We also have evidence that there's such a thing as an irreconcilable contradiction. Whereas in the case of particles, I mean, it seems a lot more cut and dry to me. So it just seems like different things are happening there that I wouldn't want to use one example to speak for the other.
So what if I said this? In the past, when people have wondered whether some animal has actually existed, many times they've confirmed that the animal existed.
What?
So
I don't think I understand. I don't think that's how that works.
So imagine someone first reporting to some tribe about this tiger.
So someone has seen it and they're trying to convince other people. Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I thought you were saying people were sitting around conceiving of animals and then seeing if they exist. Okay. I get you.
So here I am. I'm coming to, in this tribe, and I'm reporting, hey, I just saw this animal with me, and I describe it to you. And you haven't seen this animal. But then you go and you confirm, yes, the animal has existed. The animal actually exists. And you can even have this story happen a couple times in your life. And so now I'm finally reporting to you, or you're coming across a report or a hypothesis of this, now an invisible unicorn. Now we have another animal claim. And so if you can use this inductive reasoning in that particular way, then it seems like you should be agnostic about the invisible unicorn. And if you say, oh, but this is the first one that's invisible, then I can come back and pick out unique properties from the previous animals.
But each of those properties would probably be something you could find in something else. Whereas being invisible, I mean, we don't have any evidence for anything, any animal that's invisible, do we? Have we discovered that? And I don't know.
Well, I mean, you can talk about like dark matter is invisible.
Sure, but we're not really talking about dark matter.
No, but it's, I mean, it's a property, right? It's so now you've got things that exist that are invisible. So, I mean, you know the property's out there.
I don't really think that applies here. I mean, we also know that there are nuclear things, but if you said, oh, this animal's nuclear like that, I mean, I still don't think that would be very reasonable to believe. So I think you're talking about different, you're assigning properties that shouldn't go with animals.
What do you mean by nuclear?
like it was actually creating nuclear fusion somehow inside of it. I mean, you can talk about properties that we know exist. I mean, you pulled dark matter out. I mean, I thought of a star. I mean, we can talk about properties that exist that have nothing to do with animals, and then that doesn't lend more credence to the claim.
Well, no, I was just answering. You had an objection, right? So your objection was, well, the difference between the tiger and the unicorn is that these properties that, you know, are ascribed to the tiger, I've seen these properties elsewhere, or I know these properties exist.
Sure.
And the objection would be, well, now wait a second, the properties that comprise the unicorn also exist. So here, you know, and
no,
I'm, and
I said they exist in other like animals, like you can find other, you know, if you did research on the biology or whatever, like you can see that the cause of these, appearances and properties is something that's, you know, readily explainable in terms of where they come from in other animals. Whereas something being completely invisible is from our evidence of animals that live on this planet, completely invisible, unless you want to say it just has some camouflaging. That might be a different story. But the reason it's a different story is because we have other examples of animals that kind of have those kind of traits.
I guess what I'm trying to do is I'm objecting to this principle that in order for you to reason inductively in this way, that you need to have some analog in the past. And I mean, we can keep talking about examples because there are animals that are entirely unique in several respects. And, you know, even like really strange creatures. But
not biologically. If you went to the breakdown, it might be that if you were in a primitive tribe and you didn't have any knowledge of biology, that it would be quite doubtful. I mean, when you came across a creature that was completely just weird and inexplicable, because of you have no knowledge of biology, then I would say it's probably reasonable for that person to say, nah, I don't think that exists, even though they might end up being wrong. Because let me say one more thing.
Sure.
Like I said before, I mean, we're just talking about an attitude. I'm not talking about if someone comes up to me and with one of these situations and said, you need to bet your life on it, I'm not going to do it. But I'm saying in terms of because that's what you started off with, like an agnostic sort of approach to something or a high probability, you know, you brought up your three different existence claims. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, yes, if this person said, I saw a tiger, or, you know, I saw this animal has this characteristics, I would say, given three or four times of it being accurate, the next time I might say, oh, yeah, okay, there's a good chance it's accurate, unless it was something so completely wildly different from anything I'd ever heard of, and then I would be skeptical. But it's still an attitude. I mean, it might be that person has seen something that is, to me, because of my limited knowledge of biology, is inexplicable, but, I mean, still, it was just an attitude. I didn't lose any skin for that. You know, like there's no reason I would be forced to take one attitude or the other.
Yeah. So just to recap, we're in the situation where we're looking at this, the hypothesis of a particle that exists that's smaller than a quark. And you said, I agree. We can be agnostic about this, but there's a reason we can be agnostic about this that we can't, you know, that doesn't justify our being agnostic about God. What's the reason? Well, in the past, we've thought that there was a smallest particle, and then we've come to discover that there was a smaller one. And so you wanted to make this inductive move that would justify being agnostic about the smaller particle.
Sure.
And then I wanted to come back and say, well, no, this isn't a proper use of induction. Induction is grounded in law discovery, and there's no law behind discovering a smaller and smaller particle. And then I tried to give some examples to illustrate how this works out. And so I think you can pick out.
Induction is grounded in law discovery?
Yeah. So remember, if the sun's rising, you know, over and over again, this is how people like to talk about induction. The sun has risen
Sure.
every day so far, so we can expect it to rise tomorrow. the reason we can count on it rising tomorrow is because what we've discerned through induction is the existence of laws which, taken together, will bring it about that the sun rises. You know, and of course,
so if you have enough evidence for it or enough repetitions or something, how do you decide that it's a law?
The idea is we have these nice, clean, simple laws of physics, and we can learn about the world.
That we have nice, clean, simple laws of physics. I guess some of these Newtonian motion laws might be, but those, you know, obviously aren't accurate in certain circumstances. So I don't know that they're nice and clean.
Oh yeah. I mean, even at the quantum mechanical level, everything. Yeah. They're pretty clean. I mean, they're really elegant, and that gets talked about a lot. These really elegant equations. You're right. The Newtonian mechanics aren't exactly.
Well, but okay. I'm not sure if this is worth going into, but okay.
It's not relevant. So anyways, the idea is you have.
But how would you know when you're discovering a law versus not? I'm just wondering, because this is the sort of philosophy where I do appreciate it, but at a certain point you can selectively use these things to on one hand say, well, you can't, you know, disprove this certain thing, but if we weren't allowed to use induction, then what could we even do with our lives? You know, like is there certain philosophical things here that once you throw them out the window, then it's like, well, what can we even do? What can we even reason?
I love induction. I'm saying, good, let's use induction, but there are places where it's appropriate to use induction and places where it's not appropriate.
Were you saying it's not appropriate to use it in the case of a smaller particle?
Yes, I think it's appropriate to use in the case of the sun. I think it's appropriate to use in most things that we're going to talk about. But I think it would be inappropriate to use in the case of the Bible. I think it would be inappropriate to use in the case of the smaller particle. Because frankly, if you used induction with the smaller particle,
then it would never end.
Yeah, exactly. It would continue going, and every time you through induction inferred that probably there was a smaller particle, now you've got an extra particle. And now it's just confirming it, and it regresses even further, infinitely. And same thing for going in the other direction. Every time we've thought that the universe was a limited certain size, we've discovered that it was larger. Okay, and if you use induction here, what you end up getting is that there must, you know, you've deductively almost, well, it's induction, but you've inductively inferred that there is, you know, it's infinite. But both of those are illegitimate ways of reasoning. That's not how induction works. Because you're not discovering a law. There's no law that would say for any given particle, there's going to have to be a smaller particle. There's no natural law for that. Whereas in the case of the sun, you know, the sun's activities a lot of the other regularities that we refer to, regularities, these are things that are grounded in laws.
But at the same time, it's completely possible that the sun wouldn't rise for some reason that's also grounded in laws. I mean,
yep.
I'm just saying, when we're talking about these attitudes, the reason I would take an attitude of a smaller particle saying, yeah, that's possible, is because and it might be that I'm not brushed up enough on the science. And if someone explained it, then I would be wrong. But it's like, well, it seems to be a sort of a law almost. In fact, I think there is a law about, you know, our technology improving and the rate at which we, you know, human civilization technology is advancing. And so I would think that it would be reasonable to assume that we might refine our capabilities to where we could detect a smaller particle. But at some point, I suppose you would have to stop that. I mean, of course, if you extend it out to infinity, then it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. So Moore's law, but real quick, when we're talking about, I'm not just talking about discovering a smaller particle. I'm actually saying that a smaller particle exists. It's not just about discovery. Okay, but if you're going, you know, to Moore's law, the idea is that, you know, you're at a certain rate, the technology is increasing and computers are supposed to go faster and faster and faster. That is grounded. That is something that's grounded in natural laws to a degree. And by the way, Moore, apparently some people are saying that we're running up to the limits on this law.
Already?
But yeah.
Wow. That's quick. It's a good law.
Yeah, I know. It was nice.
Right, that's all we have time for today. Be sure to tune in Thursday for the conclusion of this debate, as well as some thoughts on it. And of course, or you can go on to patreon.com/atheist and gain access to the bonus content, which in addition to the early episodes is some fantastic bonus episodes that I'm doing. That's almost another podcast in and of itself. For example, this week I've actually got Blake. I asked him another question, which I found quite interesting, and he went through it, and it was fun. It was good stuff. So it's a whole different leg of the debate that you're missing out on if you're not on Patreon. So I want to thank my Patreons as usual. And look for that bonus content no later than Wednesday. All right, I will see you guys for the Thursday show. Adios.